With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. A study says that production costs are soaring for processing tomatoes. Cost to produce processing tomatoes increased substantially in the past 6 years. That's according to a study released in July by researchers at the University of California and UC Cooperative Extension Farm Advisors. Based on the 2023 cost analysis for growing processing tomatoes in the Sacramento Valley and Northern Delta, researchers found that growers faced surging input costs for expenses such as water, labor, fuel, and fertilizer. Rising production expenses translate to a 76% increase from 2017. That's the last time UC conducted a cost analysis on farming processing tomatoes. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Potential issues with electric vehicles and the almond industry. The goal of California's Advanced Clean Truck Rule is to accelerate the transition of zero-emission medium and heavy-duty vehicles. Well, Matt Clark, analyst for Terrain Ag, shares just how the range of an electric vehicle can be problematic for the almond industry.
You know, if you think back to almonds, before the pandemic, it was something like 85 or 80-some percent of almonds were trucked to the port of Oakland and then exported out of the port via boat. At the onset of the pandemic, we saw the Port of Oakland more or less get bypassed by shippers, right? And so you had this huge reshift of almonds now being trucked down to Long Beach, maybe even some rail lines being put in to try to get almonds out a different way. Well, if you think about ranges of electric vehicles, that kind of changes your perception on what you could do with almonds going out of port. So for example, I went out and I found, or I geolocated as many almond processors as I could find. And what I found is the average road distance of those processors to the Port of Oakland was only about 130 miles. But the average distance of those processors to the Port of Long Beach was 320 miles. So you think about the logistical shot of that, depending on truck ranges, and there's a lot of variables about, you know, how good your battery is, how many batteries you have, how fast you drive, what the weather's like. You know, the ability to make a straight and easy run to Long Beach and back suddenly becomes a little more of a question. You know, you're going to need to plan out at least one, probably at least one, maybe more points of charging. You're going to have to logistically think about having charging locations at the dump off spot at the port, at the load on spot, at the processor. Probably even haulers and shellers will have to think through this logistical part of it. Likewise, I looked at haulers and shellers distance to processors. And again, this all comes down to range. You know, if you're thinking, if you have a vehicle or a zero emission that has more than 150 mile range, almost all of the haulers and shellers only have a pretty good chunk of processors available to them, right? But if the range is only, let's say, 50 miles, you really shrink that radius or the number of processors that you could move almonds to from a hauler and sheller.
And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more Ag News.
Genetic resistance is going to be critical for managing the threat that broom rape presents for California. Managing Director of the California Tomato Research Institute, Zach Bagley, explained they've got several genetics projects to hopefully address the issue.
One working with Dr. Sinha at UC Davis, another working with Dr. Brady at UC Davis, a couple different areas where we're bringing in potential wild tomato genetics into cultivated tomato, or in a case of Dr. Brady's project, building up a particular substance called suberin that naturally exists in tomato roots, but can be increased with some genetic manipulation. You know, bringing those in to cultivated tomato varieties, which are available to growers, that's the long-term objective and long-term plan. So we've got research going in that direction.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait. and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, market competition and concentration in agriculture were hot topics at the Farm Bill listening session held this week at Farm Fest in Morgan, Minnesota. Minnesota Farmers Union President Gary Werdish was one of the speakers who discussed the subjects.
Agriculture probably hits the hardest with competition, whether you're selling your livestock to the 4-packers or buying your equipment from a couple, like 3 major companies, see it all the way down the line. You see it in the rural communities. The rural communities are struggling. You know, they have a hard time competing. The small hardware store has a hard time competing with the Walmarts of the world. You know, right now farmers, our share of the food dollar is about approximately 14%, and it used to be as much as 50%. That, I think, is the root of really what's happening out here. We can't just keep raising more bushels of corn and selling it for less. That's not an economic model that works for family farmers. And we want to see a farm bill that supports all farmers, all types of farmers, and really attention to a competition title in the farm bill.
Crop insurance was also a hot topic. Minnesota Corn Growers Association President Richard Syverson talked about protecting crop insurance.
Do no harm to crop insurance. It is the cornerstone of the farm safety net. Our state leads the nation in participation in this vital risk management tool. We want every farmer of every commodity in all regions of the country to participate in crop insurance the same way that we do in Minnesota. We believe this can be done by working to lower deductibles where they may be too high in some places, and by getting the risk management agency to aggressively use its R&D authorities and the private sector to use its 508H authorities to meet unmet needs of producers. We can do this. Finally, be aware of attacks on crop insurance that are mislabeled reform.
National Corn Growers President Tom Hague of Minnesota echoed his comments.
We know that the 4 pillars of the House and the Senate are going to go and be strong with it. We're worried more. Sometimes we get the amendments coming up and want to destroy things. So that's the other thing. You know, and crop insurance is a public-private entity. It works. It's proven. It's like our president from Minnesota said, 96% of the corn farmers in Minnesota use it. So that is how valuable it is. One of the other things when I testified, how important it is that I was asked a question about is the government FSA offices, should they be handling the crop insurance or the public agencies? Well, when you use the public agency, you get a better relationship with that individual, because a lot of times it's also your crop insurance and your loan officer, so you can work things together that way.
Minnesota Soybean Growers President Bob Wirth also focused on crop insurance and also the drought conditions in his state.
This is going to be my third year of a drought. And if it wasn't for crop insurance, a lot of farmers like me probably would not be surviving. And I am really concerned about the younger generation farmers that do not have the working capital, do not have the net worth to survive this. And if we don't keep our young farmers back on the farm, or get them back on the farm, farming as we know it will be gone, because us old farmers are going to have to quit sometime. And so that's so important that we do have a great crop insurance.
House Agriculture Committee Chairman Glenn G.T. Thompson said he believes he'll be ready to release the draft of the next farm bill at the end of August and plans a markup in mid-September, but only if leadership has told him what week the bill will be scheduled to come up on the House floor. The current farm bill expires at the end of September. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the summer heat in parts of the nation has really had an impact on topsoil moisture conditions. And due to this, Rod Bain notes the latest USDA report shows a worsening of overall pasture and rangeland conditions nationwide.
No surprise that pasture and rangeland conditions degradate this time of the summer in several parts of the country. Yet, as USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey explains,
that process was accelerated a bit last week with the high dry conditions in late July.
The reflection on the national numbers as of July 30th.
USDA NAS reporting very poor ratings across 29% of the U.S. pastures and rangelands. That's a sharp 5 percentage point increase from the previous week. Meanwhile, the good to excellent rating dropping to 39%, down from 44% good to excellent the previous week.
Despite the summer degradation, there are some green pastures to be found in the latest condition rating report.
The July 30th number is showing at least 60% of the rangeland and pastures rated good to excellent in several western states, including California, Utah, and Wyoming.
With some Great Plains states reporting pasture and rangeland conditions above 50%. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. Triumph Foods and a group of Midwest pork producers are suing the state of Massachusetts over its Question 3 law and others that set minimum housing requirements for livestock. The plaintiffs are challenging the constitutionality of the Q3 law and seeking immediate relief from the law before it takes effect August 24th. They also want enforcement stayed until the litigation is complete. The law was approved by voters back in 2016, and the plaintiffs say it creates challenges to interstate commerce and places burdensome costs on pork production outside of Massachusetts. The complaint comes months after the Supreme Court ruled in favor of California's Prop 12 animal housing regulations. And while both California and Massachusetts laws impose housing standards for pork, producers argue that Q3 goes further by not allowing the transshipment of whole pork throughout the state. That nuance in the Massachusetts law set up multiple lawsuits filed by restaurant, hospitality, and agriculture groups. And wool buyers from India were in the U.S. last week as part of a reverse trade mission organized by the American Sheep Industry Association. In the last 20 years, India has played an important role in the American wool export market. But exports had waned during COVID, and ASI has worked to rejuvenate this country's interest in American wool. ASI helps identify customers around the world and informs them about American wool and selling process. Understanding the needs of international customers helps to match potential suppliers. The wool buyers were escorted on the trip by ASI Wool Production Programs Manager Heather Pierce and ASI Wool Consultant Barry Savage. ASI uses funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Foreign Agricultural Service to support reverse trade missions. Wool buyers from Japan are scheduled to visit the U.S. yet this month. You can learn more about this on the ASI website, sheepusa.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do you listen?
It's just nice to have local.
I listen from 8 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night.
I just want to stay informed while I'm on the go.
It keeps me up to date with everything going on in the world.
When you put the lights on the barn, the radio went on.
It moves pretty quick so I can get the message and get on with my day.
Well, listen in the barn, skid loader, tractor, and just about anywhere you can.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Using a moth to slow the spread of an invasive plant. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The invasive Old World climbing fern was introduced to Florida's ecosystem from Southeast Asia around 1965. It soon dominated the state's native vegetation, infesting more than 100,000 acres in a short amount of time. The fern spreads quickly and has destroyed numerous native plant populations, smothering trees and shrubs with vines that can grow up to 90 feet in length. Now, researchers have found that one species of the fern-feeding snout moth is a successful deterrent to this invasive fern. ARS U.S. researchers studied the snout moth's external wing patterns, dissected its insides, and compared it to other Southeast Asian moth species. All of the snout moth's immature stages had never been seen before and were considered new to science. ARS researchers and research partners from the state of Florida are now working together to deter the spread of the invasive fern throughout the nation. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. One of the perils of having an oral farm lease is uncertainty over what happens if either the landlord or the tenant dies during the term of the lease. When a landlord or a tenant dies during the term of a farm lease, what happens if the lease is oral? If the landlord dies, the outcome is simple. The landlord's heirs step into the shoes of the deceased landlord. That means, for example, that they must follow state law to terminate the tenant if that is desired. But things are more complicated if the tenant dies. In that case, if the lease is a crop share or livestock share lease, many courts will say that the lease ends upon the tenant's death. But if it's a cash lease, the lease doesn't end when the tenant dies. The rationale is that the landlord contracted for the tenant's personal services, and that's not relevant if a cash lease is involved. One complication when a landlord dies occurs if the landlord didn't own the farm outright in fee simple, but rather held a life estate. While the lease continues, who gets the landlord's share of crops or livestock or any cash rent? It depends on state law. In some states, the rent amount passes to the landlord's heirs. In other states, it goes to the holders of the remainder interest. Sometimes that might be the same persons, but often it isn't. Of course, you can avoid all these issues by getting that farm lease in writing. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
The latest Ag Department food price forecast for this year, if it comes true, would have some pretty good news for food shoppers. Economists say we may see very little in the way of price hikes for the rest of the year. So far, though, in 2023, average grocery store food prices have gone up 4.8% from a year ago, and the forecast for all of 2023.
4.9% growth.
Agriculture Department economist Matt McLaughlin says if that forecast holds, of course, this would mean
continued slow to negative price increases. So we are not expecting prices to rebound in the latter half of the year, but rather continue that zero to incremental decline that we've seen for the last few months.
In two of the last 4 months, grocery store food prices have registered small monthly declines, first monthly declines since back in 2020. Now, to make it clear, Matt says this does not mean that we'll see prices for all foods stable or even declining. He says shoppers, for example, may see more price hikes for beef in the coming months.
Beef prices had generally been declining since late 2021, but in the last few months have started increasing again. And what we understand is that this is due to a tightening of supplies upstream, that there are fewer cattle to be brought to market.
Cattle ranchers last year and into this year had to sell off more of their animals than normal, sooner than normal, because of not having enough decent pasture to support those cattle. The drought doing a number on pastures and rangelands. So now the beef herd is getting smaller, sending beef prices higher. Matt expects for the year, retail beef prices will end up 2.7% higher than last year, but we'll see most of that increase coming over the next 5 months. The other commodity we've been covering closely is eggs. Last year, you know, we had that big run-up in prices, but the news is much better now.
We have seen some very large decreases in egg prices recently. This is largely due to the absence of highly pathogenic avian influenza or bird flu among egg-laying populations in the United States. So prices have continued to decline in response to that that lack of avian influenza, whereas last year, it had a very substantial impact on egg prices.
For this year, on average, we'll pay 2% more for eggs than we did last year, but most of that 2% increase has already happened, which is true of many food items. Matt says inflation rates will range then from a small negative movement for some products to slightly higher.
But around that zero mark for the rest of the year.
Now, that's for food bought at grocery stores, but if you're eating out, well, Matt says prices are rising pretty fast and could average 7.5% higher than last year. Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
More private crop estimates are rolling in ahead of USDA's August report a week from today. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report brought to you by Helena. Private estimates of the corn crop continue to be released between now and next Friday. Most yield estimates, though, coming in the 175 to 178 range. Those kinds of yields will result in a more comfortable ending stocks position and keeping pressure on December futures below that $5 level. Soybean yields, harder to gauge, of course, in early August, but two private estimates getting the attention of traders, 52.4 and 50.5 bushels per acre. Even at 52 bushels an acre, analysts say the stocks to use ratio would be the lowest since 2019-2020. Rain makes grain, and in the case of soybeans, 30 to 40% of the Midwest will see rain between now and next Wednesday. This is the bottom line report. Helena asks, what's in your tank? Their technology is proven to help your fungicides and insecticides work harder. Visit HelenaAgra.com to enhance your tank mix. The meat trade battling weaker consumer demand and a stronger dollar slows exports. Look for futures to be lower this next week. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
It's true. As we age, our brain's ability to process and think is diminished over time.
But there are a lot of things we can do to delay that as long as possible.
Ohio State University professor Sherilyn Jackson says one of those ways to help the brain is to move the body. She says it
helps improve the blood flow to the brain. That's really a key thing. It helps reduce inflammation. It helps to improve your cognitive health, meaning you can think more clearly, problem solve.
Physical activity also reduces the production of stress hormones in the body, increases release of those feel-good hormones, and so as a result of that,
it helps us sleep better. That, again, plays into cognitive health.
Jackson says you don't have to have a rigorous exercise regime to get the benefits of this, but just simply
getting movement throughout your day.
Jackson says just getting up out of the chair and walking around the room every half hour or so can work wonders for the brain. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for Agnet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. Been getting lots of awesome requests for ice creams and sorbets. I am here to answer and make this as super easy as possible for all of you incredible listeners and followers of the California Kitchen and the Untamed Chef. Here is my very simple recipe for a wild berry lemonade sorbet. Now, all you need, if you have it, is a little ice cream machine. And most of these you could pick up, you know, at any store for like, I don't know, $20 to $30. It doesn't have to be anything super expensive, because the secret of what we're doing is all inside of the sorbet itself. Utilizing the ingredients properly, we're able to get some really incredible flavors without having to have really incredible equipment. So let's get untamed. The very first thing I need to do for our mise en place, everything in its place, is we're going to take 1 cup of raspberries, 1 cup of blackberries, 1 cup of strawberries. Make sure the strawberries, when you do this, though, are trimmed, and try to cut them small. If you could cut them, you know, I like to quarter the strawberries when I do this. And I'm going to put these into the freezer. This is going to help with the freezing process of when we're actually going to make this beautiful mixture. Now what I'm going to do, most ice cream machines have a canister. And the canister, usually you could hear like a liquid in there. What we're trying to do is to get this frozen. It has to be frozen for us to pull this off successfully. Or there's other methods of doing this. And I assume everybody doesn't have liquid nitrogen or dry ice on hand. But I promise you the recipe is really, really simple. All I'm going to do now is take my berries and 3 cups of lemonade. We're going to blend that all together. Now, it's very, very important when you're blending this that you're going to blend this very, very fine. Unless you want to have chunks of fruit in your sorbet, there's nothing wrong with it. But this particular recipe calls for a very, very good blending of these, of the fruits with the lemonade. And it could be a pre-made lemonade. It doesn't have to be anything from scratch. We're trying to make this as simple as possible. Now, you could do this 2 ways. You can take this mixture, pour it into a pan, put it into the freezer, and I like to let it sit at least for a day or a minimum of 8 hours, and then you can scrape this sorbet out and it will be beautiful, I promise you. Or you could take it, put it into your ice cream machine, and you can let this start to churn all the way up until it starts to get soft. Once it gets soft, put it into a container. Put that in the freezer, let it sit for at least 4 hours, and then you're able to serve that however you please. Personally, the way I like to do this is to let it sit and get really, really frozen. That usually is about a good day of resting. And then when I take it out, I let it come out just for 20 minutes before I'm about to serve it, and it's the perfect consistency to make a quenelle, or like a supreme, of a perfect scoop of this sorbet. For this and many more tips, tricks, and all things Untamed, go to www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. As always, this is Albert J., the Untamed Chef for Agnet West.
Record heat in the Southwest. Rod Bain report.
A record-setting July temperature-wise? In spots, according to USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
As you move to the far west, the deep south, and even parts of the eastern U.S., it was a month for the record books.
Perhaps most notable, Phoenix, Arizona's average high temperature for the month.
This is the first time we have seen a major U.S. city reporting a monthly average temperature greater than 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Phoenix, Arizona ended up the month with an average temperature of 102.7 degrees, more than 7 degrees above normal, and that broke the previous record for any month in any year for Phoenix.
All-time record average July heat was also recorded in other cities in the Southwest, such as Las Vegas. Also,
the very warm water that's been lurking off the Florida coast has contributed to record-setting warmth in much of South Florida for the month of July.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. For today's interview segment, our friend Cindy Zimmerman over at agwire.com talked with Doug Applegate, an Iowa farmer, during the Tech Hub Live event.
First of all, introduce yourself for me, please.
Well, I'm Doug Applegate, and we're from Western Iowa and grow corn and soybeans on our farming operation. And we also have a manufacturing company, and we build automated chemical blending equipment.
Well, we're here at Tech Hub Live, and I think the first time we spoke to you was at the first Tech Hub Live.
Yes.
And that was
Well, it was only 2 years ago, but it was here in Des Moines also. What do you think about the event and how it's grown in 3 years?
Yeah, it definitely has grown, and it is kind of a premier event. So it's specialized in technology. There's a lot of good vendors here at the show. The speaker spectrum has been awesome, and so lots of good sessions for people to attend.
Well, you are on a panel, a farmer panel, on the first day of Tech Hub Live. Tell me a little bit about that panel and what you all discussed.
Yeah, so it's farmer panel and kind of a diversity of farmers. So, you know, we farm and have manufacturing experience. One of the other farmers is just a very tech-savvy farmer. And the other farmer has had some, interest in startups and farming and has both have very progressive farming operations.
So what were some of the main topics that you addressed?
Oh, boy. You know, we talked about, you know, some kind of technology trends, support, you know, value that ag retail can bring to agriculture, you know, how they can be our trusted partners and support the farmer. And, you know, that's a wide variety of things. So, you know, it's agronomic advice and sometimes technical advice with, you know, all the technology that we have these days. And it got around to carbon and like the chat, you know, the AI things, those all kind of played into it a little bit. Yeah.
You also give a little plug for Ag Gateway. And I don't think a lot of people understand really what Ag Gateway is all about. Why is Ag Gateway something that is important to you?
Yeah, so way back in our first Info Ag show that we did, we were next to Rod Connor, which was, I think, general manager of Ag Gateway at the time. And he really encouraged us to take part in the organization. And so Ag Gateway is a nonprofit where more than 200 companies are members, and they take part in data standardization. So we work on developing communications between systems. So somewhat is kind of like developing the Rosetta Stone. So different companies' data will talk to each other. And that's just getting much more important in today's modern agriculture.
And that was one of the topics that you hit on during the panel was data and whether farmers are as protective of their data as they were at first. It seems more like you're kind of like the comment was made, you're carrying a cell phone around in your pocket, so everybody knows everything about you anyway, right?
It is kind of true. You know, there's not much you can hide from the world these days. And, you know, our data is owned, you know, farmer-generated data is owned by the farmer. But yet, we have our trusted partners that we want to work with, and we all benefit by working together. And so some of the things that are really starting to happen is data connections. So we'll have, you know, software systems that different pieces of equipment on the farm integrate with, you know, our accounting and our farm management software and such things. It really leverages our management abilities on the farm.
Well, tell me about Praxidine, because we talked about that 2 years ago, and where are you at right now? Just tell me what it does and where you're at right now.
Sure. So, you know, we saw a need on our farm for blending chemicals efficiently, so make the sprayers efficient. I don't like exposure to the chemicals. I started spraying when I was like 14 years old, and so that's like a long time ago. Oh, wow. Like 50 years ago. You just half a lifetime. And anyway... So I've been doing this a long time and always had looked for efficiency. Way back when I got started, it was an open station tractor and the wind was just right and it'd blow chemicals on you and I never liked it. And so exposure is a big deal. I don't like it. But yeah, we handle these chemicals and when you can do it safely, it's fine. It's great. You know, we want to do things accurately. And in recent years, chemistry mixtures have gotten very complex. And so weeds are harder to kill. We're doing higher levels of management with these farming operations. And so you're doing, you know, more fungicides, more just better management of things. And the mixing has gotten very complicated. And so sprayers are not efficient anymore. And that's kind of where we come in. We do automated records. We load sprayers quickly. If you've got a $500,000 sprayer sitting there idling, it's lost time, it's lost productivity, and it's expensive.
Now, this is something that is applicable to just about any crop, isn't it?
Absolutely. So it's kind of that way everywhere. You know, the bulk of things we have are kind of corn and soybean belt, but we're reaching out into other crops and things of that nature. It's gradually working its way out. And so even the turf market, so, you know, people go run spray everybody's yards in town. We're getting into that and maybe some industrial things. But, you know, agriculture is the big thing.
That's all the specific questions I have, Doug. Anything else you want to add?
You know, the carbon thing came up, and the carbon thing, you know, and it's driven by the climate change narrative, which I really disagree with. It kind of goes against my biblical worldview. But a lot of things we're doing anyway, because farmers are all about sustainability. I mean, we're natural. We're the originators of sustainability, and I don't know that the general public understands that. We're multi-generational. We're doing things and sacrificing for that next generation. And so it's a big deal to farmers. And so we're always trying to be better. And, you know, things like cover crops and these things, we're doing them. We're trying to figure them out. Some of this stuff's hard. You don't just figure it out, oh, I'm going to do that next year, and it all turns out glorious. It doesn't work that way. And so, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword for me, because I don't like it that it's driven by a climate change narrative. It just really goes against my grain. But when it's agronomically correct, that we can improve our farming operations, we got long-term goals for our families, yeah, I'm all in on that. So, you know, if the general public feels good about sending some money over to the farm, yeah, we'll take that because it helps. Because, you know, like doing cover crops, for instance, it is really hard to justify that for the cost. You know, if you take a $10 or $15 payment per acre for a carbon contract, that doesn't be, I mean, that's a fourth of what it costs to do this thing, you know. And so it's adds risk to our operations and things like that. And I don't know that people really understand that, those dynamics. And so it is kind of a balancing act to be stepping into this. We have to go carefully. And we don't want to get caught with bad contracts with unforeseen circumstances and consequences. Maybe consequences is a better word. You know, we got to go carefully with it. And when, you know, carbon payments, when 80% of it goes to other companies and 20% maybe gets to the farm, doesn't seem quite right either. The overhead's way too high. And, you know, perhaps ag retail and things, you know, can be a bigger part of that because they know our operations.
It's great to see you guys here once again. And here at the Tech Hub Live in Des Moines, I'm Cindy Zimmer.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Irrigation in arid California is as complicated as it is essential. Unpredictable supplies, uneven distribution, complicated application schedules, and regulation make it a challenge. No wonder help with water is the biggest request at USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Since 2014, NRCS has invested over $100 million helping over 1,000 California farmers conserve water. By using superior technology and savvy management, farmers get more crops with fewer drops. Join the Water Savings Club. Contact your local NRCS office. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The Organic Fertilizer Association of California is hosting a sustainable pest management and production seminar at the International AgriCenter in Tulare. OFAC spokesperson Miranda Driver said there are multiple ways to register for the event taking place on August 10th.
People can find all of our events on our website. It's organicfertilizerassociation.org. And then everyone can purchase tickets online. All of our events are run through Eventbrite. So you can also find them on Eventbrite just by Googling OFAC, and you should be able to find all of our events. People are always welcome to email me as well. It's Miranda, M-I-R-A-N-D-A, at organicfertilizerassociation.org, and I'm happy to help people as well.
The next OFAC seminar will be held in Fresno County on October 26th.
It's going to be at the Portuguese Hall. It's kind of on the Fresno Eastern border out there. And that will be a very similar event to this Tulare one, full day from like 7:30 to 2 or 2:30. And then our last event of the year is going to be in December. It's a webinar. We're still working out the details, but those are 2 to 3 hours. And the date is December 7th.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Senator Roger Marshall of Kansas recently said, quote, "We're getting the heck beat out of us," on the Ending Agriculture Trade Suppression Act. While Marshall led the Senate introduction, U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson of Iowa introduced a companion bill in the House. For 2 months, members of the Organization for Competitive Markets, Competitive Market Action, the Kansas Cattlemen Association, and several other groups and organizations have declared their opposition to the EATS Act. The group called the measure, quote, "an assault on states' rights and a gift to Chinese pork conglomerates like Smithfield. They're determined to prevent the measure from marginalizing American family farmers and, quote, opening the floodgates to China's takeover of American agriculture. Enacting the EATS Act via the Farm Bill would eliminate hundreds of state agricultural laws and pave the way for even more foreign intrusion without guardrails. OCM and CMA are spearheading an anti-EATS Act campaign that began in June. And AFP contributed to that report.
The Birds Return Program is looking for Delta farmers who are willing to get paid for allowing short-term flooding on their land. Bird Returns is a flexible, cost-effective wildlife habitat marketplace designed to increase shallow flooding on the landscape for migratory birds where and when they need it most. One of the initiatives as part of that effort is the Delta Farmlands Program. This fall program requires the maintenance of shallow flooded conditions on fallow or harvested fields that are managed to minimize crop stubble and vegetation. Enrolled acreage must be fully flooded by the program start date and maintained at an average depth of 2 to 4 inches for at least 21 days between August 28th and October 13th, followed by a gradual drawdown reducing water levels incrementally over 2 weeks. The deadline to apply is 12 noon on Monday, August 14th. More information about the program is available at birdreturns.org. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media, at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.